So we begin this series of discussions on taking refuge in the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. The beginning, middle, and end of Zen practice, the simple summary of the whole practice, we could say, as well as the most simple explanation of our practice. We could say, if someone were to ask, what's the basic gist of Buddhist practice? We could say, taking refuge in the three treasures. Maybe that sounds too traditional or actually complicated, but I think it's actually really simple, and it encompasses all of it. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, clarifying the meaning of those, and also what this taking refuge means. Life is difficult in this world, from when we're born to when we die. We're faced with all kinds of challenges and how to live this life with no instruction manual that we're given at birth. That would be kind of nice if we were. Maybe some people are given some kind of instruction manuals, but they're usually not so reliable. And all kinds of, birth, old age, sickness, and death. Not getting what we want and getting what we don't want, and being apart from that which we want and with that which we don't want, and grasping body and mind and experiences as separate and limited and confined and dissatisfying ultimately. I mean, we have some good times too, but life is difficult, right? And so unreliable. So everything's impermanent and changing. There's nothing we can rely on. Family and loved ones are great, but they're ultimately unreliable, undependable, and impermanent too. They're all going to die, and we're going to die. So we try to make the best of it, often with all kinds of distractions, trying to pay too much attention to this impermanent unreliability, because it's kind of painful and difficult. So we look for all kinds of fulfillment and getting things and good reputation and relationships and people and entertainment and all of this. So I think it's just like we all have this part of our lives, right? It's so much of our lives, seems to me, is just trying to make the best of samsara and this unreliable, impermanent, ultimately dissatisfying round of habitual actions. It's kind of a bleak picture. But we have this incredible gift, this refuge of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I feel like the more I practice, the more I keep coming back to that conclusion. Is it's the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha only thing that's reliable and even worthwhile in this life and world. And the more I open to them, the more I feel joyfully it is so. And any time I try to fool myself with refuge in anything else, it's it never works out. It's just it just never works out. It's ultimately dissatisfying. So therefore, we have that opportunity to remember these three treasures and over again. And question ourselves, is this what we rely on, or what do we rely on and take refuge in? So hopefully we can keep asking that question over the course of this study. So Buddha Dharma Sangha might have many meanings, but in the kind of like Buddhist dictionaries where they define these terms, Buddha, you may know, has that that root bud, means actually awake or aware, or also to observe. These are all meanings of Buddha, related, as I've heard anyway, related to the English word bud, like a kind of a flower's kind of awakening or opening. It's the beginning of awakening of a flower. Buddha, awake, aware, or observe, interestingly. And Dharma is this very like big term that has all these different connotations. It can mean to preserve or maintain something, like to hold, preserve, or maintain. That's that root dhr. I think also same root as like dharani, is to hold. Yeah, also dharma can mean custom, habit, or standard. So like the dharma of eating oryoki meals. You know, they'll use that word in the Zen texts, like a method or a custom or a habit. It can also mean duty or obligation, like a religious duty. Like this is just a kind of general Indian term, even before Buddhism, this word dharma. Like your dharma in a certain time of life, or in a certain, maybe within a certain religious tradition, you have this dharma of serving the deity or something, like the religious duty. It can also mean goodness or virtue. These are quite different meanings, although they're all somewhat related. It can also mean truth or reality or law. And that's, I think, the main meaning when we take refuge in Dharma. The truth and reality or law. In Chinese, there's, when translating these terms, they made up new characters for Buddha and Sangha. Like, they just mean Buddha and Sangha. They weren't in the Chinese language before Buddhism. But for Dharma, for some reason, instead of just coming up with a new character, they used the Chinese character for literally like law. Yeah. You know, they could have chosen another one for like awake. There are characters that mean awake and characters that mean like assembly or community. But for some reason, that's what stuck. Buddha and Dharma. And those Chinese characters are here in this title here. You can say this is kie, means like return to and rely on. The first two, kie, and then butsu, Buddha, dharma or law, and so or sangha, butsu, ho, and so. And then ho means treasure. So other meanings of dharma are teachings or explanation. I think that's also one of the main Buddhist meanings, besides truth, reality, or law. And then you could say the teachings or explanations about anything, but you could say particularly about the truth or reality. Almost like that combination of those two meanings, maybe particularly like the refuge of Dharma. Also, I was surprised to see that another meaning of Dharma is like the original essence or nature of something. So maybe from a kind of Buddha nature point of view, you could say that's Dharma is the true nature of things. And a final definition of Dharma is the quality or characteristic, or a quality or characteristic, or element, or phenomenon. So we maybe know that meaning from like Abhidharma and like the 75 Dharmas. It's sometimes in English they do it with like a small d Dharma, it means like things or phenomena, and capital D Dharma means like the truth or reality or the Buddha's teachings. But in Sanskrit there's no lowercase and uppercase, so it's just this one word has these many connotations. And Dogen uses it also in this way that means like method, again like the Dharma of for how to eat orioki. It doesn't mean like the truth or reality of it, it means more like the method or the custom. So, and Sangha also I think is pre-Buddhist term that means like, it's still used in India for non-Buddhist communities, spiritual communities, or any community or gathering. And then in Buddhism, and then it came also to mean like the ordained monks and nuns, the Sangha. But really the Buddha also talked about the fourfold Sangha, the monks, the nuns, and the male and female lay disciples of Buddha, or followers of Buddha. And ratna means like jewel or gem or treasure or precious. I think that has it, that they call the three treasures, the three jewels, the three gems. I think seen the translation, the three precious ones. I think that's the connotation of treasure here, is it's like something rare and precious and sublime. Buddha Dharma Sangha. And I came across Bhikkhu Bodhi as these three similes for these refuges, or several like similes or metaphors that are used in the Pali Suttas. And one of them is Buddha is like the sun, shining sun. Dharma is like the rays of the sun that you know emanate from the sun and spread over the world. And the Sangha is the beings for whom darkness has been dispelled by the sun rays. That's a nice metaphor. Buddha Dharma Sangha, the sun, the rays that emanate from the sun, and those whom the sunlight touches and dispels darkness. So in a way, the Sangha is those who have this like taste or experience of the Dharma in the form of sun rays and of the Buddha that comes to them through the rays of sun. Another metaphor is almost the same thing with the moon. It's a cooler image. The bright moon of the Buddha, the moon beams of Dharma, and the Sangha is those who go out in the night and enjoy the refreshing, cool moonlight. And another classic metaphor is the Buddha is like a great rain cloud spreading over the whole world, and the Dharma is like the rain falling, and the Sangha is like the plants, trees and bushes and grass, which thrive and flourish when the rain falls. Maybe that in the Lotus Sutra there's that metaphor, yeah. The medicinal herbs. Is the Dharma the rain in the sutra, do you remember? I think it's maybe implied.
it's spelled out.
Yeah, maybe it's particularly the lotus sutra, the rain. And another metaphor is the Buddha is a lotus flower, and the Dharma is the sweet scent of the lotus flower. And lotus flower is, you know, that this pure, pure, beautiful, arising from the dirty mud. This classic Buddhist metaphor, this lotus in muddy water, unstained by the mud, growing out of the mud. So then the Dharma is like the scent, the sweet scent of the lotus, and the Sangha is like the bees who like are drawn to the sweet scent of the lotus and go and gather honey from it. Or they gather the pollen, some sort of essence from the Buddha flower, and then they make sweet honey out of Buddha. Takes like actual living people to make the honey in this from the Dharma, and the actually be drawn to the Buddha through the Dharma scent, and then take some Buddha and make honey of it. So those are, I think, all interesting metaphors to get a sense of how those three work together, particularly. And then Shantideva in old India, I don't know if it's in the sutras, but he has this metaphor of, I think it's Shantideva, of the Buddha's like the doctor, and the Dharma's like medicine, and the Sangha's like the nurse. So the doctor prescribes the medicine, and you could say the doctor assesses the situation, it makes a diagnosis. You're suffering, and particularly this patient is suffering in this way. So I make this prescription of this medicine. I could give you this Dharma teaching. Somebody else is suffering in a different way. Give them another one of the 84,000 Dharma teachings. Mm-hmm. And then the Sangha, as the nurse, is these kind of assistants to help. You could say to help the patient take the medicine. The doctor just prescribes it and gives it to them, but the nurse is like, you got to take your medicine. Sangha is like the ones encouraging each other to keep taking the medicine. The doctor, the medicine, and the nurse. And so we say in some of our ceremonies, like the precepts, when we receive the precepts in that, and the refuges in that ceremony, we list them in this, you know, to say them three times. We say, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Then we kind of like define them briefly. Our version, usual Zen Center version here for a while has been, I take refuge in Buddha as the perfect teacher, take refuge in Dharma as the perfect teaching, and take refuge in Sangha as the perfect life. And there's no real precedent for that. I think that was completely kind of made up thing at San Francisco Zen Center. It's not a translation. We'll see the other translations from the traditional ordination ceremony. But I think it's pretty good, like, pretty good one-word definitions. Buddha as the teacher, Dharma as the teaching. It has that same sense of like the sun and its rays, right? The teaching that comes from the teacher. And Sangha as the perfect life never like sat so well with me. It seemed too abstract. I actually never really got it. So when I do that ceremony now, I'm translating it as take refuge in Sangha as the perfect support. I guess maybe somebody thought life means the life of living in community or something.
Or teacher teaching students.
Maybe even if you wanted to continue that same line of teacher teaching, you could even say the taught. I take refuge in the taught. But also kind of like Sangha is teachers for us too. But support maybe has a little sense of like the nurse, like the Buddha, you could say human Buddha, Shakyamuni, but the Buddha, awakened mind, is constantly teaching, expressing itself as Dharma. And then the Sangha is like really, I think it's always emphasized, actual living people. Buddha doesn't have to be like actually like a living person. When Shakyamuni Buddha was alive, I think it did mean that. I take refuge in you, Shakyamuni Buddha. And we still take refuge in Shakyamuni Buddha, the founder. But in the Mahayana particularly, it's come to mean like the Buddha principle, or like the awakening itself, actually. And then the teachings about awakening and how to realize it. But then the Sangha is always this, like, the actual living people. And we could say also, like, that Zen ancestors who are deceased, we could say is also the Sangha. They're not exactly Buddhas. They're like Bodhisattvas.
Didn't the idea of Sangha kind of change a lot through the century? Like, you know, from the first community, didn't the Sangha, it meant, you know, those monks.
Yeah.
You know, they were ordained by the Buddha. They were the Sangha. Nothing outside of that was the Sangha, mm-hmm. I think. And then it was only as time went on that the definition of what Sangha was expanded with the change of the...
Yeah, different meanings opened and changed as time went on. It looks like the history is kind of interesting. I think there's in the Vinaya texts, they talk about, there's lots of stories, and they talk about the Buddha. It starts with the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, and then the Buddha's hanging around Bodh Gaya and sitting under these different trees, and several of us went to Bodh Gaya together, and we went to these different trees, and they have these signs that say what happened, and there's one sign for this particular event where this is just the weeks after the Buddha's great awakening, and he's sitting at the foot of the Rajayatana tree, and these two merchants, Tapusa and Baluka, came to the Buddha. He was just one of the yogis who would sit in the forest, but he was particularly glowing, maybe. And they said, "Let's offer him some rice," and they did, and the Buddha received their offerings. And then these merchants said, they had never heard of this before, but they made this up. We said, "We go for refuge to the Blessed One, the Buddha, and to the Dharma. Beginning from today, let the Blessed One count us as followers who have gone to him for refuge for as long as breath lasts." And since they were the first followers of the Buddha in the world, they only took refuge in two treasures because there wasn't a Sangha. That's interesting, I think. And maybe he taught them something, or maybe just that his glow was like the moon beams of Dharma, and that was enough Dharma for them to take refuge in. But it's kind of a two-refuge possibility. And then the Buddha, after sitting in under various trees for some weeks, and he walked to the deer park at Isipatana near Varanasi, and met his old yogi friends, and started teaching them the Four Noble Truths, and one of them got it, and then the other four got it, and they had insight. They were actually changed. They shifted from ordinary sentient beings into like noble ones. They say. With this direct insight, their Dharma eye was opened, the sutras say. And not even yet arhats. They eventually all became arhats too. But just the opening of the Dharma eye, the first direct insight into suffering, impermanence, and no abiding self, they became like the realized Sangha. And then as this Vinaya text story goes, later this young man who lived in the area came to the Buddha and got kind of mesmerized by the Buddha and left his whole life and joined the Buddha. And then his dad, this merchant, Yasa's father, came looking for him. And somehow he got mesmerized by the Buddha too. The Buddha said, I don't know where Yasa is right now, but why don't you sit down for a minute and relax. And they talked a little bit, and then Yasa's father had this insight. And he was the one who first said, "Magnificent, magnificent Lord, the Dharma has been made clear. I go to the Blessed One for refuge and to the Dharma and to the Sangha of bhikkhus," he said in this case, of the Sangha of monks, which there were five, or maybe six with Yasa. "Beginning from today, Blessed One, may you receive me as your follower who has gone to you for refuge for as long as breath lasts." So he was the first to take refuge in the three treasures, because now there was a Sangha. And
Was he Ajna Kondinya?
Oh, Ajnata Kondinya was actually the first of the five yogis who realized the opening of the Dharma eye. But apparently those five yogis didn't make this statement, "I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha." According to the sutras, it was this Yasa's son, this random merchant, who was the first to come up with that. And then it caught on. And then it actually became the way that you were ordained where you would go forth into the Buddha's homeless life as a novice. Anyway, you would just take refuge in the three treasures three times, and that was it. There weren't any precepts yet. Later, the precepts got added in. So still, we do this, going back to even before the Buddha had precepts, this way of going forth, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha three times, we still do that as our, receiving the precepts, ceremonies, and ordinations. It's always stuck in all these Buddhist countries. And you can see the precepts are like this, commentary on how to take refuge in the three treasures, we might say. So Dogen calls it the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, and the first three are refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So as Scott's saying, it looks like, I think it's Adanta Nisaro says this about the word Sangha. He says it's like, this is Theravada Buddhism. I think still modern Theravada Buddhism too. Going back to the Buddha's time, Sangha, there's a conventional and an ideal Sangha. That's the way he puts it. And the ideal Sangha is all people, lay or ordained, who practice the Dharma to the point of having at least a glimpse of the deathless, he says. And I think that means the deathless Dharma eye is open. There's a direct realization of no abiding self, we might say. And one's then called a stream enterer, not yet an arhat, but that's a glimpse of the deathless. The arhat is like living in the deathless. And and this doesn't have to be ordained monks. And in the Buddha's time, there were many lay people who had this glimpse of the deathless and were stream enterers. And that was like the so-called the noble sangha, the Arya sangha, is this have some direct realization, but not yet Buddhas or arhats.
So having a grasp of the deathless is the understanding of no self? Did I understand?
Yeah, I think that's one way to say it. Mm-hmm.
A glimpse.
Yeah. But not just having, you get into more commentaries about this in Theravada. They say you can have a really clear conceptual understanding of that. We talk about it quite a bit. I really understand. There's five skandhas, body and mind coming and going, but there's no owner of them or possessor of them. We can get that. Maybe it takes a little bit to get that, but it's not that hard. But that's not the direct realization of like, you know, it really is like hits home in this way that's maybe shocking, and a glimpse of the deathless stream entry. And so that's the ideal, what this teacher calls the ideal Sangha, is like with some direct realization. And that's what you actually take refuge in, because they've like proved the Buddha's teaching. They've like confirmed it and proved it. And they therefore, and they hold it then too. Even if they haven't realized Buddhahood. I think that's a nice way of talking about Sangha. And in the conventional sense, this is Theravada Buddhism, Sangha denotes the community of ordained monks and nuns. And then he says these two meanings overlap but are not necessarily identical. Some members of the ideal Sangha are not ordained, and some monks and nuns have not touched the deathless. All those who take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha become members of the Buddha's fourfold assembly, called Parisa, of followers. It's monks, nuns, and the male and female lay followers. So that's the Theravada take. And in the Mahayana, still, sometimes Sangha is defined as the ordained followers of the Buddha, but also this called the fourfold Sangha. So you don't have to, it's just, I think anyone who's taken refuge in Buddha is part of the Sangha. You could say formally, or maybe we could, you know, open it to even like informally, or just like I have refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So the Mahayana is this wider vehicle, right? So it includes more. But I think it's also nice to keep in mind, like, as the three refuges, Sangha as those who actually have realized Buddha and Dharma to some extent, because that's what we rely on. You could say we can rely on those making an effort in that direction too, but it might not be a supreme refuge or a reliable refuge. Some might say, well, even a stream enterer is not a reliable refuge, because until they've realized some sort of irreversibility, then they're just as unreliable as everyone else. So it depends, you know, how strict we want to be about that kind of thing. All-inclusiveness has its good benefits, I think, but also kind of like a narrower definition also, I think, has, for me anyway, has these benefits of encouragement. Like, can we really rely on 100% that will never, ever lead us astray or confuse us, you know? I think that's the meaning of refuge in its original sense. Refuge as sharana in Sanskrit, or sarana in saranam in Pali, and means like refuge. And sometimes we say, in Japanese, we say namu kiye butsu. That's actually in the Japanese ordination ceremony. That would be those first lines. Namu kiye butsu, namu kiye ho, namu kiye so. And then Buddha as the such and such, Dharma as the such and such. So that namu, or in Sanskrit, nama, it's a transliteration, means to submit or pay homage to or commit to or bow to also. So it has that kind of like, I respectfully give myself to and commit myself to. Very similar to refuge. So maybe that was the sense of combining this namu and kiye. And kiye seems to be a translation of sharana. So maybe in Sanskrit we could say nama sharana Buddha. And I think in Pali when we say Buddham saranam gacchami. I think gacchami just means like I go to. So Buddha as refuge, I go to. We translated as I go to or I take refuge in Buddha. Grammatically, we reverse it. So nama or namu means submit, pay homage, bow to or commit to. Sharana means take refuge in. I looked up refuge in the Webster's dictionary, and it comes from this French word fugere, and then with a re in front of it. So fugere means to flee or escape. Like, so that this mean, like when we talk about refugees, they're escaping something, and re means maybe back to. So we could say fleeing back to, or flying back to, or escaping this unreliable samsaric mess, or in a way escaping that, and or we're intending to leap out of that back to reality of Buddha. It doesn't mean the world disappears, right? It just means, what are we taking refuge in the midst of this unreliable mess? So, ri plus fugere, and also refuge in the dictionary means shelter or protection from danger or distress. That's a perfect word. And I think all schools of Buddhism in English now pretty much universally agree on this translation, refuge. Whoever came up with these in the early days of Buddhism, there's some words that really like work well and stick. I think Theravada and Mahayana and Tibetan Buddhists all translate this as refuge, right? It means shelter or protection from danger or distress. Pretty good. Or something to which one has recourse when in difficulty. And recourse, I had to look that up too, means to, similar to refugere, recourse means to run back. Course is like run. So to run back, turning to something for help or protection or a source of help or strength is recourse. I think very similar. We might say, I take recourse in Buddha, but I think refuge is the perfect word. And kie in Japanese is a translation for sharana or refuge. It's two characters. It's these first two in this, going from left to right in these Chinese characters. Ki means to return or to give oneself or to commit to. And a means to rely on or depend on or accord with. So it's a nice compound in Japanese. Kie means, I've seen it translated as return to and rely on. Mm-hmm. I think some groups, Zen groups even translate, I return to and rely on Buddha. Or when we do those stitches in the robe, I think I would often translate it as, you have this three part, I think we're sometimes taught, namu as the needle goes down, kie as it comes up through the other hole, and then butsu as you pull the thread. Namu, kie, butsu. I'm like, well, the English has more heart meaning for me, so I would say returning to relying on Buddha. Return to rely on Buddha. You literally like kie butsu. So ki, return or give oneself to commit is a little like the re, actually, in refuge. And a is rely on, depend on, or accord with. So something about going back and giving oneself and also relying or depending on. Similar meanings, but expands it a little bit more. Return to and rely on Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the three treasures.
Do you think the notion of praying to, asking the the Buddha, the waking mind, for help. Is this superstition or is something that is supported in your teaching?
Depends what we mean by praying or asking. And you kind of defined Buddha there by saying like awakened mind, which is like, we could say our own awakened mind, but we could understand awakened mind doesn't mean something that I have that's like some, you know, limited individual kind of consciousness. Like we could say awakened mind has no boundaries or limits, so therefore it pervades all beings. This is the kind of Buddha nature understanding. I think we could say awakened mind as Buddha means Buddha nature, we could say. And it's the same nature as Shakyamuni Buddha, who kind of like uncovered it completely, revealed it completely. All the obscurations to Shakyamuni's Buddha nature fell away, so then he was nothing but the Buddha with no more obscurations. And as the Sangha, we could have a glimpse of the deathless, but still have lots of obscurations that we get caught by due to habitual patterns. But practices like seeing through those and taking refuge in the Buddha. So you could say asking. You could say who's asking too, right? You could say, is it our limited, confused, seemingly individual self that's having this conversation with our true nature, that's asking our true nature for help? I think in that sense, that sounds like refuge.
Yeah, I kind of get that. It's kind of calling on my innermost intention rather than objectifying it to something else. That's where I would get tripped up on. If I'm not the answer and I'm kind of chanting whatever, I kind of feel like I'm trying to awaken my innermost intention to some focus or some awareness to something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that is the danger when if we're making a prayer or request to something, is the danger of making it into something. But we could, knowing that we have that, that's just what we do as human beings, we put things outside ourselves, that's just basic duality. Knowing we have that tendency and knowing it's not quite like that, but as a skillful means, we can say, well, since things do appear that way, then I, the limited being, can call on this true nature.
You know, the view of Avalokiteshvara as being able to hear the cries of people in distress, and at least in China, with Avalokiteshvara, Guanyin, was viewed, I guess, more or less conventionally as a goddess that one could ask for help.
Yeah.
You know, when people were in distress. And,
and it was still, I think the kind of maybe folk version would be like, she's actually like a person, invisible person in the sky kind of thing. But I think the deeper understanding, I could still understand her as a refuge to call on as like not so much a person in the sky, but as the complete embodiment of total unhindered compassion. Mm-hmm. She is that, which means awakening. That kind of principle, almost like not exactly embodied. I mean, then we can get into the three kayas as what embodiment means. You know, the Dharmakaya that has no physical body, and the form, the Rupakaya is the form bodies as like manifesting in some form that looks like holding a vase with a willow branch to sprinkle the healing water. I think there's room for what we might call prayer or request or asking. But then being careful not to make that into like a dualistic separation either. Yeah, it's a big topic actually. But has to do with refuge also. Let's say refuge in the everlasting Shakyamuni Buddha whose Nirmanakaya form passed away a long, long time ago, but who only appeared to be born at that time and pass away at that time, but Shakyamuni Buddha, like as in the Lotus Sutra, eternal lifespan of the Buddha, we could take refuge in that. Like Shakyamuni Buddha as like Dharmakaya in a way, that Buddha. So Dogen wrote this essay on taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and near the end of his life, I think it's kind of the end of the Shobogenzo. I think it's undated, but he didn't. It says at the end that Ejo, who found the draft, said it wasn't yet edited, so Ejo just kind of maybe touched up a little and published it as it was. Sometimes the Shobogenzo compilers talked about this 12 fascicle version of just like the, near the end of Dogen's life, and it has this different flavor than the earlier essays like the Genjo Koan and stuff, and they're very like almost like very conventional teachings near the end of Buddha's life about how we have to have total trust in cause and effect, and taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and arousing bodhicitta, all these kind of classic Buddhist teachings. Dogen kind of brought up again as he approached the end of his life, interestingly. He's like, we got all the radical Zen stuff, now we need these kind of like grounding basic practices to carry on forever. Maybe has that sense.
Didn't the story with Dogen as he was approaching death began to, as I recall from my life, there was a pillar of some sort in his room.
Yeah.
Where he was living.
Yep.
And as I recall the story, he would just circumambulate this post, taking refuge in Buddha and Sangha the whole time as he approached death, which I have always been very moved by the story, thinking about such a great to realize being. And
doing such a conventional practice.
And his last, his last gesture toward is to take refuge in Buddha and Sangha. I think it's very touching in a way, I suppose.
I think I heard it as he wrote Buddha Dharma Sangha on a piece of paper, or a little like plaque, and put that on the post. That's so funny. Then he could circumambulate Buddha Dharma Sangha in a simple way. Dogen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, near the end of his life, apparently. Yeah, some kind of devotional expression. Yeah. Remembering. Yes.
Well, since Patrice's talk, she mentioned that Suzuki encouraged us to actually practice taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And I've been kind of flirting with, well, what is that? Not just saying it, not just saying it. What would be the practice?
That's the question, exactly.
Yeah. I was teasing Rachel, this morning we were at the Pride Parade in Watsonville, and saying, what part of taking refuge is this? Because it just was so lively. And we were so lively, and maybe I was a little bit manic, with parade, and waving flags, and I was saying, which one is this one? So, but it was good. I hadn't heard that about that line from Suzuki Roshi about what would that practice be? That's not just not just vowing it, but enacting it. So.
Yeah, so I think saying it could be a practice. especially if we're actually paying attention to it, mm-hmm. kind of feeling it as we say it, which is easy to not do, to just say the words one more time. But also, hopefully we keep exploring that as we talk about these, what is practicing it.
FYI, that talk, I just downloaded that talk about an hour before she did that, her Dharma talk. Like, I just happened to be on that, and it's a July 12th, 1967. It's on the San Francisco Zen site. And it's a really good, and I read it before. It was actually told me, somebody had told me to read it, and I read it, and then I, because of the class, I brought it up again, so I just printed it out, and then she talked about it. So weird.
Kismet.
Yeah.
I was going to ask this earlier when you were focusing on Sangha, and what Patrick said made me think. I mean, my immediate response to that was, well, that was Sangha. Yeah. The parade was Sangha. But if there's an exclusivity to what is Sangha,
yeah, well, why do we say taking refuge in? One time my teacher said, he defined Sangha, I think when somebody asked, is whoever or whatever encourages us to practice. So I thought that's not just everybody and everything, although if we're really, really open, it could be everybody and everything. I thought about, in a way, the more awakened we are, the more we could have this encouragement from, like, those who really hate us, or, you know, include, like Donald Trump, maybe. Yeah. It's like Sangha, because he actually really encourages me to practice. I thought that was a nice way to put it. And then if there's some who really don't encourage me to practice, they just distract me from the practice, then I could say it's, why bother calling that Sangha unless we aspire to be encouraged by them? But I thought that was one nice, pretty inclusive definition of Sangha, is those, and it could even be like birds or fish or something, right, that are encouraging us to practice. And so it's more inclusive than just realized ones or those practicing Buddha Dharma. But as we, just offhand, when we say, how do we practice taking refuge, if we see Buddha as kind of this awakened mind, Buddha nature, we could say that Zazen practice, even like, you know, formal Zazen practice, or any time that we're like intending to really open to that mind of reality, is the practice of taking refuge in Buddha. And Dharma, we could include Dharma and Sangha in that too, I think. But if we want to distinguish them, we could say Dharma would be, like, in this case, like studying the teachings about awakening to Buddha, if we look at it as teachings. And in those verses, we like the full moon verses, Buddha, I take refuge in Buddha. Literally, it's like, may all beings, it's a prayer or it's a wish for, we say before all beings. I think that kind of misses that intent of the Japanese, which is, it's like, I take refuge in Buddha, and then making this vow, may all beings embody the great way, awakening unsurpassed mind. And then Dharma, I take refuge in Dharma, may all beings enter deeply the treasury of sutras, literally, the Japanese says, into wisdom like the ocean. And we take out, maybe to make it more inclusive and not limit it to this, to sutras, we'd say the Buddha way or something, right? You know, before all beings, immersing, you know.
Bringing harmony?
No, that's a song.
Entering deeply the merciful ocean of Buddha's way. So it does have the original, let's say, entering the deep ocean, but took out maybe the, people are like, what about it? We don't need sutras, we're Zen. But it's really the sutra treasury. So I think that those verses particularly emphasizing Dharma as these like teachings that come in words, you know? So like a discussion like this is, you could say, practicing taking refuge in Dharma. and then practicing refuge in Sangha. Yeah, that verse is like, may all beings harmonize with the great assembly, free from hindrance, or bringing harmony to everyone, free from hindrance. And we could say, so then practicing, in that sense, practicing refuge in Sangha could be like trying to live in harmony with everyone through the Bodhisattva precepts and so on. So there's one way we could look at practicing with them.
Could you say that the assembly of the Sangha, it's just like everyone who was taking refuge in Buddha?
Yeah. In that verse it says the great assembly, which kind of implies, sometimes they use that in Zen language to mean like the those in a Zen ceremony, those in the, like the great assembly now does 9 bows. But if it's really great assembly, yeah, those harmonizing particularly with those who are taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, but even those who aren't or don't realize they are harmonizing with the greatest assembly of all beings everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Like a little more in practice, when you say, may my intention be directed toward lasting peace in the Sangha, that's the first line.
And
I always thought that was
a
beautiful thing to be reminded of every morning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a practice.
Lasting peace in the Sangha is something you, you practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For others.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Mm. So, but Dogen also talked about like this reciting part, this actually saying, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. He's got this other essay, also near the end of his life, called Mind of the Way, Shobogenzo Doshin, where that's like another translation of bodhicitta, having the way-seeking mind of the way. And there are very few who have mind of the way in these degenerate days, Dogen says. But if we want this, remember impermanence, be firmly determined to make the Dharma weighty and your body and life light. Put more emphasis on the Dharma and less on yourself, I think we could say. And next, deeply respect the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Aspire to respectfully offer yourself and to them and revere them life after life. Asleep or awake, respectfully remember the merits of the three treasures. Even when you leave this life and enter this intermediary realm between lives, within the 7 days thereafter, keep thinking of and reciting the three treasures ceaselessly. So how do you do that if you don't have a mouth anymore? But interestingly, he could just say, keep taking refuge in the three treasures after you die and as you're going through this intermediary period. But he says, keep reciting, take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So it may be connected with his own practice, as Scott mentioned. He's approaching his death and he's walking around this pillar reciting, I take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And he's saying, I want to keep doing this even after this body dies. We could say, well, why does it matter to recite? And maybe we could say the principle there is like just not forgetting. We're constantly distracted from the three treasures of, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma. Sangha as the chaos of the intermediary realm unfolds upon us with its terrors and confusion and whatever might come. So then it's also in this interesting place where Dogen talks about going through the bardo. We might say, Zen doesn't really talk about that, but he's saying, it's a 7-day period, and then you die from that 7-day period into another 7-day period, and keep taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and reciting them during this time, And then at most, these periods won't exceed 7 days. At this time, in this intermediary realm of the bardo, one sees and hears without obstruction, as if through celestial eyes and ears. But keep reciting the three treasures strenuously, strengthening your mind and not forgetting to recite Namu Kiye Butsu, Namu Kiye Ho, Namu Kiye So, reciting incessantly. And after passing through this intermediary realm and approaching your father and mother joined together, which should be your next life, try to be conceived with right mind wholeheartedly. Sometimes Dogen would talk about these things, right? As you're approaching your father and mother in union, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Buddha. Also, while in the womb, keep reciting the three treasures. At birth, at the moment of birth, don't slacken in your recitation. And receiving your six sense faculties in your new life, deeply desire to dedicate these senses to the three treasures. And keep reciting and taking refuge in the three treasures. So, that's what I think would be the ideal. Yeah, so it's kind of an unusual essay of Dogen there.
Yeah.
Shobogenzo Doshin. Yeah. And really emphasizing this taking refuge. And in particular, kind of curious in a way that he says, recite them, keep reciting this.
Yeah. He was doing just that.
Yeah, and he was doing just that. Yeah. And maybe it's this encouragement that if we're going to be born again and again, this is the main thing, or else we could go through a whole life after this in some other kind of body or life form that completely forgets reality and just wastes that life. So I think that's the meaning of it, is like, we got to remember, if we get a little glimpse in this life, yeah, it's so precious, and then we just, let's not waste it and just go back into oblivion again. Yeah.
So just side note, this sounds like Dogen historically totally believed in reincarnation. It doesn't sound like he's speaking like metaphorically, or is this something that he came back from China with, or what's the...
Well, it does seem like, because I have heard some contemporary people say the Zen school and Dogen, just didn't believe in the rebirth thing. That's a pretty good example. It gets pretty detailed. And he has other essays too about karmic retribution or karmic effects in the three lives, which is this life, the next life, and then future lives after that. And it's not that he's making this up. This is all just Indian Mahayana Buddhism, particularly this thing about the seven sets of 7 days, 49 days.
That's pretty, like,
specific. That's Abhidharma Kosha, which is Dogen apparently read when he was like 7 years old, three times or something. And Suzuki Roshi said before he died, when asked, what should we study in the future, he said, if you can actually, it was just being translated into English at that time, he said, try to study the Abhidharma Kosha. It's this huge collection of, like, summary of all Buddha's teachings collected by topic, and so it's possible to do now. And that goes through a lot of details of these kind of things, like intermediary realm. So this is not a kind of Tibetan invention. This is Indian classic, actually Pali Canon. Pali Canon, I think, doesn't have the 49-day story, but the Buddha talks a lot about how the rebirth process works. And that was, in fact, the goal in Theravada Buddhism. It's still the goal in Theravada Buddhism, is to not be reborn again into this cycle of samsara. And then rebirth, in a way, it kind of defines that shift into the Mahayana in some ways, is we vow to keep coming back again and again to help others. Yeah. So in both cases, they're using this teaching about cyclic rebirth as kind of almost like the heart of the practice in some ways, defining these different schools. So some might say it's just a side issue, but in, I don't know, maybe it's kind of a major issue related to the goal in both Theravada and Mahayana. And I think as far as like, should we be thinking about that all the time? Well, maybe not, because let's work on this life. Yeah. I think that's the emphasis in Zen especially, is that we practice to be free in this life. But it does have this larger context.
Mm-hmm. So the Abhidharma was in Japan
already? Yeah, it was in Japan already. Dogen studied it. Mm-hmm. Abhidharma Kosha, written by Vasubandhu.
Yeah.
Abhidharma is the collections of the Buddha's teachings, pretty much like after the historical Buddha passed. But then Kosha means like treasury. So that Vasubandhu put together this treasury, this huge collection of like all these other Abhidharma teachings, and even like all these finer points. Had like sort of debates with himself in this text, why it's so long. He's like, some schools see it like this and some see it like this, so it's really beautifully extensive. Someday maybe we turn it into a 10-year class series.
Yeah. With lots of muffins.
We did to
help it kind of go down.
Yeah. It's hard, actually really hard to read. The language is...
Well, I mean, the one we've got is that one translated from the French.
Yeah, from the French.
And so it's like language that we don't usually
use. Yeah.
But didn't Nagarjuna kind of refute some of the Abhidharma as far as
Abhidharma
kind of reifying certain aspects?
Yeah, well, I think we could say he was pointing out the ultimate truth, that none of these conventional categories ultimately hold up, but conventionally they're all the great conventional teachings. So we could say from Nagarjuna's point of view, the Abhidharma Kosha stands as this beautiful explanation of how the mind works, rebirth is a conventional teaching, suffering is a conventional idea, liberation is a conventional idea, all these teachings are still hold as the story of Buddhism. And then Nagarjuna is saying, but all of it's empty, ungraspable. Mm-hmm. So, because the Abhidharmists also had things like there really are partless particles that really exist and make up conglomerations of things.
Mm-hmm. So
Atoms, yeah. So Nagarjuna would say, we can't really find those either. So to begin this essay of...
So, I'm sorry.
Yes,
please. I was like, I'll ask later.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, I feel like I'm just forgetting something historically, but when we say that Dogen was the first ancestor in Japan...
In our lineage.
...for this school.
Mm-hmm.
So the other, like, the materials were already coming.
Yeah, there was Buddhism in Japan I think like the 5th or 6th century, and Dogen was the 13th century.
Oh.
So there was particularly Tendai and Shingon Buddhism, I think came early on.
And then Rinzai.
And then Rinzai then came a little bit before Dogen, but not much. Mm-hmm. Like Eisai was one of Dogen's teachers, or at least Myozen, who was Eisai's student, definitely practiced with Dogen, and there's some question of whether Dogen met Eisai, but Eisai was the first Rinzai teacher. So it was like within 50 years before. There were maybe other Zen teachers coming, but maybe they weren't bringing the whole package of koans, collections and things. And but like Tendai Buddhism, right? Dogen was ordained as a Tendai monk,
mm-hmm.
was thriving in Japan before he went to China. Brought Zen, yeah. And there was actually a school in Japan called the Kusha School, which is the Abhidharma Kosha School. It was there was like a Madhyamaka and a Yogacara school actually in Japan. And there was an Abhidharma Kosha School where that was like that was like they based their whole teaching on the Abhidharma Kosha.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in terms of Japanese transmission, what was the first lineage to arrive in Japan?
I think it maybe was. I mean, I know that like Tendai and Shingon were around the same time in like the 7th century. That was like Kukai and Saicho were these teachers in the Heian era. And but before them, there was Buddhism, but it might have been like almost like non-sectarian, just like basically like some Buddha statues. And I think I heard that the Buddhism first came with a statue of Vairochana, the Dharmakaya Buddha. And that was, so sometimes it comes first in this material thing. Wow, it's awesome. Golden statue. There's something about that. And then what is that based on? Well, here's a sutra that kind of goes with that weird school. And so it might have been like, yeah, I can't quite remember, but maybe like general Buddhism. So Dogen says, beginning this essay, which is sometimes called Shobogenzo Kie Sambo, which is taking refuge in the three treasures, and sometimes called Kie Bu Po So, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's listed with different titles, different places. Dogen says, the first of 120 questions in the guidelines for Zen monasteries says, do you revere Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha or not? So this is just one of Dogen's reference books, the Chanyuan, Chingwe, and do you revere or venerate or have devotion to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? So it's not exactly refuge, but I think it's a question for monks to ask themselves. Then Dogen says, thus it is clear that what the Buddhas and ancestors in India and China have authentically transmitted is reverence for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, or veneration, or we could say what they've authentically transmitted is devotion to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, that character means. Without taking refuge, there is no reverence or devotion. Without reverence, there's no taking refuge. So it's like slightly two different things, but almost the same. Maybe the reverence, veneration, and devotion are more this kind of heartfelt feeling. And then refuge is the actual, like, I'm placing my trust in these three treasures. So they're related. And Dogen's big on this, like, authentic transmission ordeal. So Buso Shoden, the Buddhas and ancestors' authentic transmission. So actually it says that on the Ketimyaku, the blood vein, blood lineage documents you get at Jukai ceremony, it says Buddhas and ancestors, correct transmission, Bodhisattva, great precepts. So it's the same phrase, Buso Shoden, Buddhas and ancestors, correct or authentic transmission. So that's one of the Dogen phrases that he's, I think as he's establishing a new lineage, he'll use a phrase like that. It's like a power phrase to mean like, what we're talking about here is like the essence of this new Zen movement called the Buddhas and Ancestors, which means the Zen, it's a way of saying the Zen lineage is the Buddhas and Ancestors, authentic transmission. So he'll use that for various things, but here he's saying the Buddhas and Ancestors authentic transmission through India and China is reverence for Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. You know, at the beginning of any essay, he could say the same, that the Buddha's ancestors' authentic transmission is just wholeheartedly sitting. You know, but all these things are different names for the same authentic transmission. The act, or literally here it says kudoku, the merit and virtue of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, is achieved through mutual affinity and interaction. And that's this Japanese word kano doko, which means mystical communion. This interactive inquiry and response, calling forth and response, and the way of merging. So this is, we have this, it, this came out in a newsletter and a Buddha Dharma article, magazine article, right, on, that I put together on this mystical communion or Kano Doko. So it's, Dogen only occasionally mentions it. He talks about it in when it, saying bodhicitta, how does bodhicitta arise, this aspiration for awakening? That arises in Kano Doko, or this mutual affinity and interaction, but also taking refuge is achieved or arises through this mystical communion. And briefly, it's we could say it's like the mystical communion between Buddhas and sentient beings. It's like when a sentient being has some wish or aspiration or openness to meet Buddha, then Buddha, which is like our true nature, our true awakened nature, responds to that. Mm-hmm. So Buddha nature is always
out there waiting.
I think in this article I spoke of it as like, it's like a radio station sending out awakening vibrations, but then we have to like tune in the radio. It's always coming at us, but we have to like tune it, and as the sentient being, and to receive the signal. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that we tune it like this, you know. And then and just open to that, and then the signal is always already coming at us. Oh, there it is! But I was too busy and distracted to notice it.
That's our
Yeah, I get a lot of feedback often. It's a blurry signal. So that's something like this mystical communion. Buddhas meet the sentient being. And we could say within ourselves, we could talk about it like Avalokiteshvara as the personification or archetype of great compassion that we open and pray to and meets us. This is how often people would talk about this. We could talk about it. There's nothing outside, actually, either. It's like our own compassion and wisdom. We, the little sentient being, opens to that, and there's a meeting called mutual affinity and interaction, and that's how taking refuge happens.
Is that one word in the Chinese?
No, it's like four characters, actually. Kano Doko. Whether you're in a deva realm, a god realm, a human realm, a hell or demon realm, or an animal realm, whether you have mutual affinity and interaction or mystical communion with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, when you have that, then you invariably take refuge in them, or inevitably take refuge in them. So it's not even just humans saying in all of these six realms of sentient beings in samsara, if there's some opening to Buddha, then Buddha can meet us, and that's refuge arises, which is very different sounding than like, okay, I gotta like put my trust in Buddha now.
Yeah, it sounds like it sort of arises simultaneously with this, when the radio station is just right.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is it mystical communion, but it's also the completeness of taking refuge in Buddha Dharma.
It's a two-way signal.
Yeah. We could see it if we take... I think trust is a nice word also for this refuge, putting our trust and security in this, or trusting this, that which is completely safe and secure called Buddha Dharma and Sangha, that's totally reliable and doesn't come and go, doesn't let us down. So we could say, if we open to Buddha, then Buddha meets us, and then there's this natural feeling of trust, like, that is trustworthy. This big mind is like, I can trust this. And we could say that's a moment of taking refuge, like, despite ourselves. Mm-hmm. Or we hear, maybe also hearing Dharma, we hear some Dharma teaching, and it's like, yes, I have no qualm with that teaching. It resonates with me. Even the words resonates with me as a person. I take refuge in that Dharma. And Sangha could be like a practitioner that inspires us on the path. Just their practice creates this kind of resonance with me. Like, that looks like a reliable support for practice, or that, or a practice, a living demonstration of practice. I take refuge in that. I trust that. So without even thinking of them as taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, maybe it could be.
Kind of look at Dharma as, or try to look at Dharma as like looking at the moment, like just trusting the moment. I wonder how crazy the moment is, just to follow that moment rather than my idea of the moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
trying
trying
to meet your moments, or trying to meet your life, so to speak. You know?
We could say going beyond our ideas is a kind of a version of Dharma.
Yeah, my car
limited
down,
ideas.
I get it fixed, you know. I just go, you know, the next thing, whatever, you know, I respond to the inquiry, rather than, you know, coming up with some ideas, you know, suffering because, oh my God, now I'm stuck out here, and I'm like, yeah, me, me, me.
Yeah. But maybe for it to be really like a Buddha, Dharma, Sangha moment, it would be free from all our ideas of even what a moment is, actually, in the if we go even deeper into it, beyond even time.
What would you be trusting? You know, what are you?
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems like we're trusting the one thing that's not something to get a hold of. Like it's easy to try to trust things that we can see and hear and touch and feel and so on. But this is something that Buddha, particularly, we could say, is something that's it's ungraspable. How do we trust something ungraspable? That's a great question.
Yeah, it seems a little complicated.
Yeah, and yet maybe that's the very thing: is we start seeing more and more everything that's graspable never works out. So maybe all I can trust really is what is ungraspable. But we can keep exploring this more. It's because our time is about up. Then we consider over the next week what is, what is trust, what is refuge, what is security, what are we, if we're not taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, what are we taking refuge in? I feel like I'm taking refuge in all kinds of other stuff, and it's like, doesn't seem to work so well.
And then on Tuesday we trust Saul with the trusting mind.
Yeah, the trusting mind is a refuge mind.
Yeah.
Well, we dedicate the merit from our gathering to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. May they shine their light on all beings. Beings are numberless. To save them, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become them.